This is Morning Edition on WNIJ. I'm Dan Klefstad, opening the book bag again for more great reads from Northern Illinois authors. The first writer in our winter book series is well-known to fans of jazz, especially big band music. Ron Modell started the NIU Jazz Ensemble in 1969. Under his leadership, the ensemble gained an international reputation, and NIU became known as the place to study jazz performance and education. Ron has a new book about his life and his career called Loved Being Here With You. Ron Modell, welcome to Morning Edition.
Well, it's wonderful to be back at these studios. I've spent quite a lot of time here with both WNIJ and WNIU, and I am a yearly contributor to NPR.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Ron, you come from a family of musicians, including several who have had successful careers as trumpet players. I'd like you to go back to that first moment when you picked up a trumpet and tried to play it. How did the trumpet feel in your hand, and how did it sound?
Well, it really was an incident where I had an older brother named Sandy, who was 3 years older, and my mother decided that she wanted him to study trumpet. So having two uncles who were very prominent trumpet players at that time, one was principal in the Cleveland Orchestra, Louis Davidson, and one was later to be principal trumpet in the Dallas Symphony, Milton Davidson. They recommended the best trumpet teacher in New York, whose name was Bert Pennino. And so my mother and I and my older brother went down to his studio in Manhattan. He was 10, I was 7. And no matter how he tried, my older brother just could not make a sound on the mouthpiece or the trumpet. And I, being 7 years old, kept saying, "Let me try, let me try." And finally, to quiet me down, the teacher said, "Let him try." And I immediately played. And the teacher looked at my mother and said, "Don't teach Sandy, teach Ronnie." And so that was my first introduction, really, to the trumpet, although I must tell you that as a young infant, my mother said I cried most of the day until 5:30 in the afternoon when she flipped on the radio and a big station in New York used as their theme the very famous Clyde McCoy's Sugar Blues, which was very, very popular.
Can you just hum a bar from that?
Yeah. Ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-da-da. And he used a mute and he made a growl in the trumpet. So Clyde McCoy was really one of the most popular trumpeters around 1934-35. Hmm. And so it was sort of preordained that trumpet was going to be part of my life. I mean, it just, that's the way it was going to be.
Now, throughout your earlier years, you studied the classical repertoire and you became a first trumpet in several different orchestras. What did a classical education give you that lent itself to other forms of music that you played, including jazz?
Well, yes, I was trained strictly as a classical player. I started formal study when I was about 10 with Jimmy Smith, who was the first trumpet in the assistant first trumpet, New York Philharmonic. And we worked out of the Edwin Franco Goldman, who was a very famous writer of marches, almost in the Sousa style. And then I went the next year or two to the fourth trumpet of the New York Philharmonic and was studying, again, strictly classical. And as I got into the early high school, I became aware of an orchestra in my neighborhood called the Bronx Symphony Orchestra. So at age 14, I got in my very first amateur orchestra. And once a week, these people who were doctors, lawyers, secretaries, who had musical training and now, of course, could not pursue it as a career but never wanted to give up their musical abilities, would get together. And I remember the very first piece I played was the overture to The Barber of Seville. And most music for trumpet players in a symphony orchestra, I would say 80% of it, was not written in the key that your trumpet was in. Most trumpets are in B-flat. For instance, the Barber of Seville was in the key of A for the trumpet, which meant every note that I looked at on the written page, in my mind I had to drop down a half a step. Or there was another system, which I did not learn, called the clef system of transposition, but mine was by interval. So you had to learn at least 6, 8, 10 transpositions in order to be able to play the symphonic repertoire. And I studied that very vigorously. And later on, I got my first job when I was 15. There was an area in New York State called the Catskill Mountains where they had perhaps 300 or 400 resort hotels at that time. And you would work from July 4th weekend through Labor Day weekend. And it came in handy because I learned how to play shows. I learned how to play dance music. I did not become a jazz player, which is really the only frustration of my entire musical career. And it was all my fault. I had every opportunity, having had the greatest jazz players come to Northern and perform with the jazz ensemble, and to study with one of them. But I was not willing to put in the time and dedication and devotion that it takes to when you learn improvisation, it's like learning a new language. It's a completely new learning, new scales, new modes, new chords. And also, I think when I was very young, somebody told me jazz players or improvisers were a dime a dozen in New York, but lead players made twice the money of jazz improvisers. So I became a lead player. But I was always frustrated that I could not improvise. And only a few times during my career was I called onto the stage, and all of a sudden the dancer who was doing the show said, "Let's improvise some blues." And luckily, because of a clinic Clark Terry, the great Clark Terry, had given here at Northern, I was able to get through it.
Now, speaking of your years at Northern, you took a faculty position at the NIU School of Music when there was no jazz program. How did you go about building the jazz ensemble and the jazz program here at NIU?
Yes, the job description that I came under was associate professor of classical trumpet and director of jazz ensemble. And that was really unusual for that time. When I was born in 1934, you were not given a choice. You either were going to be a classical musician or you were going to be a commercial player, a jazz player. But what happened was it became a matter of survival, because back in those days, orchestras did not have 52-week seasons. When I did my first symphony orchestra, it was a 20-week season. And I was married with a child. And what were you going to do? Actually, it was a 25-week season with Dallas. And the Catskill Mountains saved me, because I could go from Dallas, pack up everything in the car with my wife and child, and drive to New York City. And we would be given free room and board as part of our salary at these hotels. Although in this case, I would rent a bungalow. We had a lot of bungalows up there. And it was a tremendous help to make a career as a performing musician, because there would be no way that you could sustain yourself. For instance, if you were a violinist or somebody, a violist, a cellist, there's no work like that in the Catskills. It was strictly woodwind, brass, or percussion, or piano, or bass. And so I was very fortunate and learned how to play shows. And as I got from one small hotel with perhaps 100 guests, I ended up at the Concord Hotel, which had 3,500 guests with 5 bands. And we were playing people like Joey Bishop one night and Harry Belafonte the next night and just Buddy Hackett. It was a great experience and a great learning place. It was like the minor leagues when I started, working up to the major leagues, to where you would have a really marvelous experience.
It is hard to imagine today a hotel anywhere investing money in 5 different bands, all these different musicians, the entire entertainment schedule of that hotel being around those musicians, the shows that they would appear in, the dances that they would play for. Today, of course, you just put on a CD or even your iPad.
And I don't believe out of the 300 or 400 hotels that there are more than 2 or 3 still open. Mm. They all closed down. People got tired of going up to the mountains. They had been doing it for 50 years to get away from New York City's heat and humidity. And then all of a sudden it became the trend to go cruising. And so you'd go on a boat, But, you know, when I interviewed Quincy Jones a few years ago for the Instrumentalist magazine, I think he said it perfectly when he said to me, I would not have wanted to live in any other period of time than the one I lived in, because we had Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. And that's the same period. We're just a year or two apart, Quincy and I. So I think he was right.
I want to get to Q in just a few minutes, but I want to also get back to your time here with the NIU Jazz Ensemble and in the music education program here. You brought lots of famous musicians to play with the ensemble, including legends like Duke Ellington, who gave his final performance at NIU.
Correct.
The interesting thing about this is that you also did clinics at area high schools, part of a recruitment tool to get young musicians to learn more about the program at NIU. And so how common was it at that time, the early 70s and into the 80s, how common was it for legendary musicians like Duke Ellington or Clark Terry to give clinics with college musicians at high schools and working with high school students?
Well, I think they welcomed the chance. It's funny you should mention this question. This morning, I received an email from our new director of jazz, the NIU Jazz Ensemble. Reggie Thomas's wife, Mardra, sent me an article that had been in, I think, a Chicago paper by an author named Jim Zantner. And it talked about the fact that I had talked Woody Herman into doing his very first clinic ever with his band right here at Northern. And it opened up a brand new world for Woody Herman because the bands were struggling. And now, all of a sudden, being able to offer a high school Woody Herman, his orchestra, for an afternoon clinic.
Free.
Free, yeah. And then the evening concert, you know, was their regular fee. We started our jazz ensemble in 1969, as you mentioned. And all I did was put up some signs around the music building and in some other places that there were going to be auditions for the very first NIU jazz ensemble. And I was elated that 60 kids showed up, but also was very difficult to cut the 60 down to 20 because that's the size of the big band. And that stayed with me all 28 years. That first week of school, I feel like I earned 80% of my salary, because when you go through a week of rigorous auditions every night and you're hearing 30 or 40 musicians play the same thing over and over and over, and you know where they may have been kings or queens at their high school and been the top dog, they've reached a new level of competition here. And, you know, after a while, I could see in their faces, well, is there at least a place for me here? And, of course, that's when we, after a couple of years, started our lab band, which was the next band in order. And we ended up having three big bands. And then, of course, the combo scene started when we got some faculty that were well-versed in improvisation and composition and arranging. We had very famous Frank Mantooth was here, who was one of the top guys, and just got us going with a wonderful program. And then Antonio Garcia, in about 1987, when he came, he actually wrote out the curriculum so we could offer a degree, an undergraduate degree in jazz, which we had never done during my period of time. And boy, that... it put us on the map in the educational world, but it was 1978 when the band was invited to be the number one attractive group at the National Association of Jazz Educators, which was held in Dallas, Texas that year. We were the Saturday night feature with Dizzy Gillespie as our soloist. And, you know, it was so funny, after we performed, I had a number of people come on the stage and say, where the heck is DeKalb, Illinois? You know, just when I first heard of DeKalb, Illinois, the first thing I heard was it's very famous for barbed wire and corn. And, of course, as the years went by, we were so fortunate to have the support of, like, WNIU with Bob Davis, who was one of the early supporters of our band, and the great Roy Leonard on WGN, and
Bob Schumann of
WNIJ. Schumann in Rockford, and then Dick Buckley on WBEZ was one of our biggest supporters.
Yeah, that great old low voice.
The most wonderful radio voice. Yeah. But was also like an encyclopedia of jazz, you know. And then, you know, as we started to go out and recruit, as you mentioned, I would simply ask a school if they could pay for our bus and give us some lunch, and we'd do an all-school assembly. And, you know, when you do an all-school assembly, it's so different from just having music majors. So what I would do would be to introduce the young students in Galva and Serena and Coal City. I would go to all small towns, you know. And the first half of the program, I wanted them to know about Duke Ellington's music and Count Basie and Stan Kenton. But I always finished the program by doing what was current and which they would recognize and appreciate. And if you think back in the early 70s when we started to do this, the big two groups were Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And we were lucky to have a vocalist named Jeff Jenkins who could really emulate David Clayton Thomas, I think was his name, in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So we were doing a lot of BS&T, and then all of a sudden one of my female students, a percussionist named Beverly Nadich, introduced me to the group Chicago. I had never heard them. And it was a tune called Beginnings and another one called Do You Really Know What Time It Is? And I just fell in love with their music. So when we went to schools, we tried to introduce them to the basics of jazz, Count Basie and Ellington. But then we always left them, always, with the feeling that we want to hear your music. We want to play your music. And I think if I could leave one legacy of the 28 years, one of my mentors was Leon Breeden, who was the dean of all college jazz band directors at North Texas State. He said to me, when you go to Northern Illinois University and you get your program going, if every concert, at least 50% of it, is composed or arranged by your students, you will have reached the apex of where you should be. And if you listen to our 13 recordings, at least 50% of it is student-composed or arranged. And every concert we did, every single one, had two things in it. It had student composition and arrangement, and it always had Count Basie.
A high point of your career, and certainly that of the NIU Jazz Ensemble, was playing the 1996 Montreux Jazz Festival as Quincy Jones' big band featuring Phil Collins, Chaka Khan, Patty Austin, other great artists. In your book, you write that you were invited by the festival organizer, Claude Knobs, I guess?
Yes, Claude Knobs.
To participate. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what it was like to be part of, to actually to headline one of the world's most important music festivals.
Well, it was groundbreaking because Claude Knobs had made a rule, which he had never broken, that the main venue, which is called Stravinsky Hall, would never permit a college band to play there. It had to be only the highest professionals. And you know the old saying, you have to be at the right place at the right time. They had engaged the number one big band in Europe, which comes out of Cologne, Germany, called the WDR band, to do this 50-year retrospective of Quincy Jones' music, featuring Phil Collins and Chaka Khan and Toots Thielemann. And the concert was to be held on July 19th. And somewhere in mid-June, they found out that half the WDR band was on tour with Tony Bennett and Phil Collins and would not be available. And the very same day that he received that fax, there was another fax from the aforementioned Leon Breeden from North Texas State, who had played for Claude Knobs at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1970. They were the first college band. And in the fax from Leon Breeden to Claude Knobs, it said, Dear Claude, I understand the Northern Illinois University Jazz Ensemble will be performing at Montreux this summer, and I truly believe, after hearing 400 or 500 bands during my career, that this band deserves to play in Stravinsky Hall. So here was the one fax saying you don't have the WDR band. And this one from Leon Breeden, the most respected college jazz band director in our country. So Claude Nobbs immediately faxed Quincy Jones Leon Breeden's fax. And Quincy Jones said, I know Leon Breeden, and if he said that band is that good, get him. So the next afternoon, I received the fax saying, would you be available? And you would have to come for 4 days, 3 days of rehearsal, and then the fourth day. The fourth day, Dan, our kids were on the stage from 10:30 in the morning until 1 a.m. We did the show twice. We had to block it for TV because it was being made into a video, which is still available. It's called Quincy Jones and Friends in 1996 at Montreux. And one of the most highly respected musicians in L.A., a woodwind specialist named Gary Foster, when he saw the video, and he's a very good friend of mine, he wrote me, and in an email, he said, Ron, there's not another band on this planet that could have played better than the NIU Jazz on. And my wife, who's a non-musician, she said to me, what happened to this band tonight? It was like, you know, well, you can imagine the thrill of we arrived Tuesday afternoon. We rehearsed for 6 hours on Tuesday, 7 hours on Wednesday, 9 hours on Thursday, and then from 10:30 in the morning to 1 a.m. And imagine those kids having Quincy Jones in front of them and Chaka Khan over here and Patty Austin over here. And also, what's his name? David, very famous alto sax player.
Sanborn.
David Sanborn. I mean, there are pictures of David Sanborn sitting with our sax section, along with Gerald Albright.
Another great sax player.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. You know, they were rubbing elbows every single day and eating sandwiches together in the place where we were rehearsing. And it's a memory that those kids will have for the rest of their life. And, you know, it was funny, and I write about this in the book, that when we were going to do our very first rehearsal with Quincy, I knew that our kids were on such a high that I needed to do something to settle them down. So I called Quincy and I asked if we could play a couple of our tunes first before we got into his music, figuring that would give them a chance to settle down. And it did work. It worked beautifully. And also I wanted him to hear a great, great vocalist we had that year named Stephanie Knox, who was doing Quincy's arrangement of Ain't Misbehavin' that he had written for Ella Fitzgerald. And after hearing her sing, he immediately asked her if she would join the vocal group he had brought from Cuba. So that what a big thrill for her. But it was one of those things where our international reputation was just, you know, all over the world, people were saying, where is Northern Illinois University? You know, it was such a rewarding experience.
I should mention that Quincy Jones wrote the foreword of your book.
Yes, he was very kind to do the foreword, and he's a very sweet man. And he called me in February of 97, after we had done this in July of 96. And I was in California for a wedding of my cousin and at Dana Point. And he got a hold of me and he said, you know, in March I'm doing this big cine festival in Stade. They call it Stade. It's got a G at the beginning of it, but it's Stade, Switzerland. And he said, I have a Monday rehearsal with the London Metropolitan Orchestra, which if anybody saw the movie Mr. Holland's Opus, the London Metropolitan Orchestra was the orchestra that made that movie, and it was the best players of all the London orchestras put together. And he said, I really cannot make the one rehearsal on Monday in London on March, whatever the date was. Can you and Kathy fly over on Saturday night, arrive on Sunday, and then do the rehearsal for me Monday? Which I did. And it was such fun because you can imagine the absolute perfection of this orchestra. I mean, all you had to do was give them a downbeat and just step out of the way. And the strangest thing that happened was we did the rehearsal Monday, and then we flew to Geneva, Switzerland on Wednesday, Kathy, my beautiful wife, and I, and Henry Mancini's wife and daughter, his widow, I should say, she was appearing on this festival. And the Friday night concert was for Quincy Jones' 64th birthday. But then the next night, the festival was going to honor three of the greatest names, fathers in show business. They were going to honor Quincy Jones and his daughter Jolie, who was a great singer, would sing, and Vincent Minnelli. So Liza Minnelli came, and Monica Mancini represented Henry Mancini. So here we are, Wednesday night, we had a rehearsal from 7 to 11, and then Thursday morning we had a rehearsal, and the head of the festival came to me after the rehearsal on Thursday morning, and he said, "We would like for you on the Saturday night festival to conduct three of Quincy's movie scores." I said, "Really? How much rehearsal time will I have?" He said, "A half an hour."
Okay.
So, and I didn't know any of the music scores. I think one was called McKenna's Gold, which I remember had Gregory Peck, and there were two other ones. So all the rest of Thursday and Friday, as my wife will attest to, I sat in our hotel with scores and just, you know, there I was Saturday night conducting Quincy's movie scores with him sitting right in the front row. And this magnificent orchestra, the London Metropolitan Orchestra, was magnificent. And it was a great thrill.
I'm sure a lesser conductor would have just said, "Let's just vamp on the Peter Gunn thing."
Yeah, right, right.
Shortly after that performance, you retired. And then 10 years later, you gave your final performance on the trumpet with the DeKalb Municipal Band. Why did you put down the trumpet?
When you've played at a certain level all of your life, I refuse to go below that level. And I was not willing, for whatever years I have left, to put in that time and devotion and dedication so that when you walk on the stage, you feel you're giving your A game every time. And I thought, I'll just quit, you know. And I had no idea that something would occur that never dawned on me.
Well, let's talk about your career in stand-up comedy. You've performed at the McCurdy's.
McCurdy's Comedy Theater in Sarasota. This will be my ninth year. And it was strictly on a whim. Most comedy clubs have a night where they call it open mic. And they will invite, they have to know that you know what you're doing. And I told a joke to Les McCurdy one night, and he said, "You know, I'd like to have you try open mic one night. Just go up there for 5 minutes and see how you like it and see how the audience likes it." Well, the very next day, Les McCurdy engaged me to become a regular at McCurdy's. So when we go down to Florida, which we leave the end of December and come back the first week in May, I will do a week in February and a week in April. And I've gotten to the point now to where I do 15 to 30 minutes prior to the headliner. And Les McCurdy opens the show, and he's the greatest at getting an audience really going. And then he turns it over to me, and of course I'm doing the kind of material, I almost feel like Tony Bennett when he was rediscovered, you know, at MTV, that this new young audience just fell in love with Tony Bennett's voice and his choice of material, because the most exhilarating response I've had in the last couple of years has not been from the 60 to 80-year-olds, but from the 21 to 40-year-olds, right, who all of a sudden have discovered that you don't have to say a lot of bad words to be funny. You know, I mean, I use my, you know, my repertoire, which has a little salty stuff in it, but never vulgar, always clever. And I had great teachers, because when I started in 1950 in the Catskills, I was doing shows with Lenny Bruce and Buddy Hackett and Joey Bishop and Dick Shawn and Shecky Green, who were all learning their trade at that time. So it was like the minor leagues, as I said before. And I happen to have a phenomenal memory. And, you know, I can, the great drummer Louis Belson, rest his soul, he wanted so much for me to sit down one day. He said, "I want you to come to my home with Pearl Bailey, and we're going to get 12 or 16 of our best friends over, and we just want to do a 45-minute video of you telling stories." and market it, you know. And I'm sorry it never came to pass, but it's that kind of thing. So many people who I've been with during my life have always said, oh, I wish I had my tape recorder.
Well, we are rolling audio right now, of course. Do you have a reasonably family-friendly joke you can share with WNIJ listeners?
Well, I love this story. It's about an atheist who goes deer hunting and takes a shot at a deer and he misses. And he sits down to reload his rifle. And all of a sudden, after a minute or so, he turns around and standing behind him is an 8-foot grizzly bear. And this atheist looks up to the heavens and says, if there truly is a God, you'll give me a sign right now. And the next thing he hears is the bear saying, thank you, Lord, for the food we're about to receive. Now, that's very mild from what I usually use at the club, you know, but a lot of my act, if you will call it an act, is based around the humor of New York City, which has a special brand of humor that's like no other city that I ever went to. It's kind of a wise guy, you know, kind of thing. Also, the Catskill Mountains was almost 100% Jewish clientele. So all of the material that I heard was basically another great line. And it's simply, this is typical Jewish humor. A homeless man walked up to a Jewish woman on Broadway and said, lady, I haven't eaten for 3 days. And she said, oh, I wish I had your willpower.
Ron Modell is the author of Loved Being Here With You at WNIJ.org. You can hear him read an excerpt from his memoir. Ron Modell, thank you very much for coming here today.
Thank you.